Hey everyone, it's time to kick off another exciting edition of our DevOps Office Hours. It's July 19th, 2023. My name is Eric Osterman and I'll be your host. I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. Cloud Posse helps teams conquer AWS using our rock solid Terraform blueprints. Whether you're starting from scratch or just not satisfied with your current setup, book a session with me by going to cloudposse.com/quiz, answer a few quick questions, and we'll have a call to show you exactly how your team will succeed. For those of you new to the call, don't worry, our format is super informal. My goal is to answer your questions. If you're curious about Cloud Posse or any of our open source tools and modules, this is a great place to ask. For those of us joining through the podcast or YouTube channel, we host these calls every week, so don't miss out. You can register for these live and interactive sessions by heading over to cloudposse.com/office hours. Again, cloudposse.com/office hours. Our call today is recorded. We'll post a recording of this session to our YouTube channel. So if you want to help and support what we do over here, please hit those like and subscribe buttons. It helps us out a great deal. Just head over to youtube.com/cloudposse. Again, youtube.com/cloudposse. It's also a great way to share the sessions with your team. If you found something useful today that you wish the rest of your team could have seen or heard, share the video and they can stay on the same page. So with that said, let's dive right into some announcements. As a reminder, I believe next week we are doing the quick talk on advanced renovate bot usage by Maxim Blaslov. He has been going pretty deep into renovate bot, and you might have seen some of his other presentations. He's going to do a quick presentation for us and then answer any questions you might have on how to use renovate bot in a scalable and sophisticated manner. So one article that caught my attention, obviously, as an open source company, it is this one here from the Apache Free Software Foundation, and they're sounding the alarm for a impending act going through Europe, I guess. It's called this Cyber Resilience Act. The spirit of it, I think, is well-intentioned. I think the impact of it is what we're all concerned about, and the effort is to put more onus on the software developers or manufacturers to have basic checks and balances for security and a reporting process and so forth. Apache has been proactive in trying to scale this legislation back so that it doesn't apply to open source software. That's about as far as I came in the article. I'm curious, I know we have other people in Europe, if you've been following this at all and have any opinions. All right. Well, check it out, and we will move on to the next announcement. A bunch of security things have come up in the past week. There was a remote code execution found in OpenSSH's SSH agent. It requires that you have an existing functional account on the machine for the RCE to work. And it taps into how dynamically loaded libraries are used and loaded and unloaded. And that apparently there's some way you could drop like a vulnerable library into /temp and then load that through the SSH agent process. Similarly, or not necessarily similarly, there was another supply chain attack. One here at Google Cloud, which taps into how images were pushed to the registry, and it allowed to, I guess, tap into the service account that Google Cloud uses to write images to the registry. So therefore you could override Docker images and create a supply chain attack. There was another attack against Microsoft. Somehow some of their master signing keys were compromised, and this allowed some attackers to access the email accounts of apparently some government officials. Microsoft has, for all the good that Microsoft is doing, and they've obviously turned a corner, they've had some unfortunate continuation of security issues. Just seems like they can't get away from it. So Vlad isn't able to join us today. He shared, this was something different. So this was a different one. So you'll remember a couple of weeks ago, a lot of companies, ourselves included, and our customers were affected because all of a sudden there was an additional intermediary key that needed, like a thumbprint of a key that needed to be trusted if you're using GitHub OADC with AWS. So we had to scramble and roll out a fix for that. Well, fortunately now, just a couple of weeks later, that is no longer necessary, and those fingerprints are automatically loaded. So there's no harm in having the fingerprints there that you have, but in the future, it's not necessary if you upgrade. Matt Calhoun, did you look into this anymore? I'm not sure if you're on the call.
I am. I guess the only harm would be if they revoke one of the intermediate certificates and you're trusting that. I guess that still wouldn't affect it. You'd just be trusting something that's revoked at that point. So yeah, I think this is like they just did the smart thing that doesn't require you to know every intermediate certificate because they trust the intermediate certificates already.
Yeah, makes sense. Okay. GitHub has gone passwordless. So they announced an initial preview of passkeys. It's pretty easy to set up. You just log into your account, click your profile photo, and enable feature preview or expand the feature preview menu and enable the passkey option. So with that enabled, you can just use your fingerprint to log into GitHub if you're on a Mac. Has anyone already been testing that? All right. Next announcement. This one was from Vlad, who couldn't make it today. Vlad pointed out that ECS Fargate has just gotten 30 to 75% faster. There were some tweaking of ECR. Basically, I guess you need to do some tweaks of ECR images to make ECS Fargate start faster. I haven't had a chance to look into the announcement itself. Anyone else look into this more? All right. Seekable OCI. What is Seekable OCI? Anyone know what that is? All right. Then let's go into the next one. The last announcement, or the second to last announcement, was Code Build announced some preliminary support for GitHub Actions. The way it was introduced sounds a little bit premature. Vlad has a post on this one as well. I should have linked to it. I forgot to. But what he called out were that there's some pretty significant limitations if you go with this route, as are listed here. For one, the context, I believe, isn't supported maybe. And yeah, it doesn't work with Windows jobs. Won't work on builds inside of a VPC without internet access. That goes without saying, since it has to hit the GitHub API. Basically, it's using the GitHub API, I believe, to trigger the workflows. All right. Let's see here. Last one was, we talked about Mermaid recently. So Mermaid is a great way to do diagrams within AWS. Within GitHub. GitHub supports Markdown embedded Mermaid diagrams now. The problem is the Terraform graph can be overly complex, as we see on the left. So someone's written a small utility that helps strip out perhaps some of the extraneous edges of your graph. So you get something that looks like this here. A much more readable diagram. So if you combine Terraform Graph Beautifier, presumably with the Mermaid action, you can get some even more valuable diagrams for your Terraform. All right, that's all the announcements I had. Did anybody have something that works for, or like any announcements for AWS? Matt, nothing interesting on AWS this week?
I honestly have not been able to spend much time looking at things, so I'm useless this week.
Quite all right. All right, let's see. Do we have any announcements in the news here? Or I mean in the Zoom chat? Nope. All right. Now let's check the Office Hours channel. Looks like 1.6 alpha was just released of Terraform. So that means their 1.6 release is probably pretty imminent.
And they took Terraform test out of experimental too, which is nice.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Have you been using it?
I have not, no, but I hopefully will soon. I'll be playing around with it.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's move into Q&A then, if there are no other announcements. I don't have any prepped questions. So yeah, fire away. Any questions?
It might be a long brief. I don't know. Just wonder if anybody had any tips for working on AWS type stuff in a disconnected state. And I say that because I'm going to be on vacation. I'm going to be on a cruise. So I'm going to have some time to like focus on some stuff. And it would be cool to like, I don't know, have local stack or something like that on a laptop where I could work in a disconnected mode. Just wondered if anybody had any tips on that.
I feel like it's come up here and there. The general consensus that I've garnered is that it's really impractical these days, as there's so many dependencies and everything else you depend. And that while you might get it working technically within local stack, you know, even doing a Docker build and the dependencies and the NPM modules and other things like that you might need. So I don't know the extent to your work. I think it really depends on what you're working on.
Yeah. You can always point
to, you might be able to write offline.
Yeah, you can always point to the AWS Royal Caribbean region.
That would be awesome.
The local zone, you mean?
Yeah, they have it on every cruise ship now. I've used LogoStack quite a bit, and TLDR, some stuff works and works pretty well, and a lot of stuff doesn't. So that's kind of my experience with it. So I don't know how much success you'll have doing that. You can always spend the $200 for a week and get really slow satellite internet access. I was just on a cruise a couple weeks ago, and that's what I ended up doing, but it wasn't great.
Yeah, and that's what I'm trying to avoid. I know that I could probably cache some dependencies if I know the project in advance that I want to work on. That's what I'm trying to figure out now. But I'm trying not to run up a $500
They don't have Starlink things yet?
No, they do. It's like $23 a day or something for your cruise, and you have internet, like full and unlimited internet access, basically. But it's just not the speediest. And there are spots that you go that it definitely is not working in certain spots, but it's just not great.
I just thought Starlink is pretty fast, is what I hear. But
yeah, I don't know if the boats have Starlink. That would be pretty cool. But the package that I looked at is AT&T, and it's $100 a month, but they give you 1 gig of data for the month, and then it's $10 per 100 megs over the cap.
Yeah, I don't know about every cruise line, but I was actually speaking about like Royal Caribbean, for example, has Voom, like the same people that they use on the airplanes. So they have Voom like on the ship, and you can pay them, and it's about $200 for the whole cruise. And in some spots it's pretty quick, but in other spots it's kind of slow.
Yeah. I would say those spots that you're probably closer to land where they could hit a cell tower or something.
Yeah, more I think it's satellite based.
Take a real vacation instead of trying to work.
Yeah, I support that.
Yeah, I'll stick with the Mai Tais then. Thanks.
I did some basic stuff, but really using the functionality is quite crappy. And even stuff like trying to run some Terraform examples just to get through the motions, mock stuff like that. Usually you want to play with special services that are not yet incorporated for those things. So, yeah, not really fantastic.
And not that you were asking, but we've like played around with ACT a lot as well. And I think everyone gives up on that as well for a local way of doing GitHub Actions. All right. Any other questions today?
Hi, I had a question.
Go for it, Charlie.
What's a request, really. Hang on 1 second. Can I ask in a second? The door's just going. 1 minute.
Yes, I have a question for later. But Yeah.
Any thoughts on yesterday's CloudFront outage? It seemed to be brief, but it caused us some pain, and yet again was very difficult to find in the moment on the AWS status page. It was everything is fine. So we actually diagnosed our outage from Hacker News. It's like, that's got a problem. But any more experience thoughts on it?
Yeah, I don't have much to add other than, we were bit by it. We saw the Terraform registry was bit by it. Even if you fix it for yourself, is it going to fix all your dependencies?
I think Bitbucket Atlassian was also bit by it. So, pretty wide outage.
Yeah, not sure what the right answer is, because often engineering for like, all of these situations ends up costing quite a lot.
Almost always when GitHub has a problem, the text message comes to me before I realize GitHub has a problem. And that is almost never the case with AWS. I always find something broken. And then, 4 hours later, there's an admission broke. That really bothers me because we depend on AWS, and GitHub seems like it's ahead of all those problem reports and very, very transparent about it. Are there any services to kind of give you better heads up or better alerts on AWS?
A couple. One thought in an ideal world, but I don't think it would solve your problem because, as you said, AWS's status page wasn't getting updated. But with OpsGenie, you can pull in dependent services that are having outages and escalate those. I think there's also a way to do that on statuspage.io, is to pull in related status pages of services you depend on. But it doesn't help if those services haven't updated it. The interesting thing is Down Detector, or one of those type of sites, tend to be pretty effective, especially for major services like AWS, because they just get such an obvious influx of reports that even if there's nothing been updated, you can see that, well, it's an anomaly in terms of the number of reported issues.
Yeah, I think Corey Quinn had stop.lying.cloud set up with a better AWS panel. I don't know if he had some issues with that. So now it just redirects to Down Detector. But yeah, the crowdsourcing page there is probably better than any AWS panel, because yes, they are at least 30 plus minutes behind on announcing any outage.
Yeah.
Thanks.
All right. Discover seems to be doing some synthetic testing as well on those kind of cloud providers. So that could be worth having a look.
Yeah, I guess you could always add your own synthetic checks.
Well, Stateicator does already provide some of those. So,
what service does?
Stateicator. It's in the chat as well.
I didn't see that. Let me open that up and see. Statuscator. It didn't open up on the right window here. Hold on. All right, so Statuscator, private team. So it's like a status page IO that can also pull independent.
Yeah, but they do some, what I understand is that I haven't worked with it yet, but it looks like they pull in some additional testing and not just report on what is provided by the vendor itself. So they do some additional testing.
Cool. Thanks for sharing. All right. Charlie, did you want to ask your question?
Yeah, sure. So at my previous company, because it was relatively small, I didn't have to collaborate quite as much on repos. I had quite a lot of free reign to just, you know, be working on my own thing for a while. Didn't really matter how big, you know, the sort of pull requests I was doing ended up being. Now it's not the case. And so I've basically been learning about what are ways to manage this. And one of the things that comes up a lot as a solution is using stacked PRs. But I'm finding it a bit of a nightmare, to be honest. I was wondering if anyone's got any recommendations about workflows around that or tools. I mean, the only one that I've really come across that seems to be out of infancy is that helps a bit is Machete. But other than that, I'm not really sure what else is out there to help with it, because it's a bit of a pain. But yeah, I was just wanting to know if there's any advice around that, really, or any tools people can suggest. So, I mean, Git Machete essentially does quite a lot of the heavy lifting in terms of keeping everything, you know, rebased with the relevant branch that it comes off of, rather than you having to go for each one and manually do it to keep everything up to date.
I gotcha. Yeah, I personally don't think I have too much to add to it other than I feel your pain. It is especially, I don't know, somehow, you know, if you're doing a lot of refactoring, if you're doing, you know, in my case, more Terraform, it's pretty hard sometimes to think about it in smaller pull requests. What I've done in those situations, personally speaking, and it's nothing as sophisticated as this, and it's nothing you haven't probably thought of, which is I still make it big, but then I refactor it after I get it working into smaller pull requests. And, you know, that's reasonable.
And so when you, how do you go about doing that? Because even that, there seems to be quite a few different.
I didn't personally. I've never reached this level of sophistication as something like Machete. I just did it manually. You can also chain. You can start a new branch. You can chain your PRs so each PR merges into the other PR, so that you ultimately have one PR with all the changes. But that allows people to conceptually follow what's going along, comment on the respective PR and the changes. But when it ultimately goes into main, yeah, it's all of that bundled in one. So it could still technically be a large PR, but it was manageable.
So I'll just add, I refactored like our space lift components not too long ago, and it was a very large PR at the end of the day. But that's the exact like approach I took. I had many smaller PRs that I merged into like a single branch. So I created a branch for refactor space lift components. Then I opened like 6 or 8 different PRs into that branch that people could review things in small chunks that actually made sense and comment them on. And I could iterate on that several times until we got to a point where we all agreed. And then I merged that into the one larger branch. And then that one larger branch, once all of the PRs had been reviewed and agreed on, that one larger branch basically just got merged into main without actually reviewing it again. It was basically just see all these other PRs that were already reviewed that created this branch, and that's how we did it. But I know it's not the best way, but at least it's manageable in that case to be able to read it, you know, be able to read it and figure out what the hell's going on in, you know, each one of those small chunks. Because if you read the whole PR, it's often you can't even figure out what changed or why.
Okay, gotcha. Thanks.
Well, anyone else have something to add about their strategy? All right, let's move on to the next questions. Any other questions?
Yeah, I've got one actually.
Fire away.
I know we all try to automate everything, and I do as well. But I was just wondering if anyone knows of any tools where you can set them up with a simple GUI, maybe self-hosted, maybe not. And you can put in like reminders of things you want to be reminded to look into. For instance, there's some things that you can automate. If you're using, for instance, AWS private TA, those certificates expire after 1 year. You have to go in manually, delete it, recreate it. And just an easy way to get, you know, a reminder at a schedule.
Slack? you can even do this in a team channel, for example, and it becomes just part of your discipline that when you see those things, you set a reminder to post to the channel what's going to happen. But yeah, if you want something fancier than that, I'm open to other suggestions. Anyone else?
I would also suggest that your whatever task tracking tool you have probably has a way to do that as well. So personally, I use I use Todoist for just to do things that I need. And I can add that really quickly with a reminder on a date that I want to be reminded on. There's ways in Jira to do it by setting like due dates, and you can see things pop back up. You know, with those types of things. And I'm sure there are, you know, a million other ways. Your calendar also is a really good thing that that has reminders on specific dates as well that you can add to. So I don't know. I mean, I think there's a lot of tools. Without standing up a new tool, there's probably a tool you're using today that you can already use to do that. That's kind of what my take would be.
My main takeaway based on those suggestions is just that based on the example, like a SSL certificate, if this is in a company context, I would be miffed if, I mean, it's great if you have a personal reminder, but you know, you might not be here in a year when, you know, you win the lottery or whatever. So a shared scheduled task of some kind, I think, is called for.
Yeah, or something like a monitoring tool that you can also use to check dates and reminder dates. Something like, normal for certificates, you can monitor how much days they are still valid. So you have your basic monitoring for that. You can point it towards something else. The ticket system is always quite good. We use it also for some of the hard to transition from dependencies that have an end of life. Okay, it's nice to have a ticket for that so that you can also have a quick view ahead. Hey, what's coming up?
Yeah, so
it's not a personal hack. That's the
main. Well, yeah, if that specific example, that probably helps with. But if this is things like, you know, once a quarter we need to audit these things. Once a month we have to check, you know, that permissions are correct for across all these groups and that all terminated employees have been terminated. Like all of those kind of shared reminders. Like the best way I've found to do that in the past has basically been either the task, like the scheduling, like task system that you use, you create a recurring task in there, or you have a shared calendar that is shared across like your team members to have all of those things. But both of those things, I think, can be accomplished without needing another tool.
Yeah, we basically use Jira also for that, with some automation that regenerates that kind of task also for info security things.
That's what I was just saying. Yeah, same idea.
Jira, so you always have an overview of what's open. And it just regenerates those tasks based on tags.
I mean, this might be over-engineering it slightly, but if it was just for your benefit and it didn't really matter, it wasn't setting reminders for your team or for the company, you could just create some bash functions and then alias, you know, whatever commands. So say, for example, I can't remember what the example was that you gave, but you need to do it in 6 months' time after it's been set. You could alias the command that you use to a bash script, which then just sets a reminder either through, you know, like the reminders app or through some calendar, something like that.
Thanks, that's helpful. It's mainly for my team. And so I will look into the calendar / Jira automation rules suggestion. Thanks.
And your question just prompted something that's been going around in our team lately, and we're starting to update our docs with it. It's a great little site called endoflife.date. So it has, at least for our sake, a lot of the software we depend on in here. Also, EKS being one that, you know, they're only supporting the last, was it 5 or 6 releases on AWS, and Kubernetes is dropping what feels like a new release weekly. So staying on top of it has become a chore. What's cool about this site is they have, you can download a live calendar feed, so you can see when your Kubernetes versions are expiring. And what's interesting from a team perspective, you can actually then do this on a team calendar that gets shared amongst like the platform team or something like that, which has the end of life versions of your software in a place that is relatively convenient. When you're looking for things generally in your calendar, you would see then when those things expire.
It's a great,
actually really cool. Thanks.
Yeah, I'll share it in the channel. Thanks to Andre on our team for finding this.
I it's more of a curiosity question that leads on from that, being you know, in a group of DevOps people. What is the borderline for something being essentially a waste of time to automate? As in, I found it before where I've spent hours doing something where really it's saving, you know, a couple of seconds or something, but it's more like the idea of automating it is nice, but there's a balance in there to be made between those things. I was just curious what people think that is, essentially.
To be honest, I have found that it's not really about, I mean, calculating the time saved is helpful, but for me, it's more about enshrining the various steps, because I might forget, oh, I have to do this before I do this. So even if I'm just going to run it like one other time or two other time, the fact that it's automated means that I don't have to think about Google search, try to search my terminal history to see what things I did to get to where I wanted to go.
Yeah, but in that example, if you just had a sort of runbook script where as part of your automation thing, it gave you, you know, it presented, oh, you know, do this thing, and that thing involved, you know, clicking through an interface and it took you about 10 seconds or 20 seconds to go through the interface and get it set up versus spending hours and hours and hours automating some convoluted process to automate that. That's what I guess what I'm talking about. And but I do get what you mean about it. It has its own usefulness in just making sure that you
everything right.
as expected.
The runbook idea could work as well. But then I've also been burned by copy and paste errors. And so I don't know. I just usually just default for let's automate it. And that way, because I make mistakes so easily. So maybe it might be a user error issue.
I think you should also factor in the idea of that if it's automated, you don't have to remember to do it. So, you know, there's a benefit there as well that I think is worth some hours of development.
Yeah, most of the times I also find that you only do it once, but then you do it again and again and again. Normally also when you're trying to do it and figuring it out, if you already put something in code, and it could be something bash scripts or whatever, but very basic, but then you know what steps you did, you can reproduce it because there's always a next time you have to do it. Perhaps not tomorrow, but in 2 weeks' time, it's like, hey, crap, you did something, you have to refer to it or whatever. But it's, yeah, it's always...
The word of caution is, from our experience at Cloud Posse, I think we've kind of really, this is kind of introspective, you know, we really drank the Kool-Aid when it comes to automate everything. And it also goes into backend operations and like our Zapier account with hundreds of Zaps in there. And I guess on the one side, we wouldn't have been able to accomplish as much as we have if we didn't automate as much as we did, perhaps. But that's the lie I tell myself. But the other thing is that suddenly then these automations start breaking and they themselves become technical debt. And then, you know, like our office hours process that we have here, that's all automated with Zaps. But every now and then something's breaking on YouTube. And it's also a big distraction having to keep those current. It can bite you.
It can be a huge time sink and yak shaving expedition as well.
I shared a little video there of what it feels like sometimes when you're doing these things and you realize, oh, okay, so we're just deploying Kubernetes and you got to monitor it. And then you got to monitor for the versions of Kubernetes. And then what checks that the thing checking for your versions is actually checking for versions? Because now you depend on it and you assume it's running. So do you have a heartbeat checking that that thing is running? You know, it's just like, it never ends if you really think about it. All right, good questions. Any other questions we can get to? I have an open-ended question, kind of. Has anyone had experience versioning services or parts of a monorepo, and then how did you do it? Interestingly enough, on Weekly TF, I saw a post on it. I haven't had a chance to read through it, but it related pretty specifically to our situation, which was this managing Terraform modules in a monorepo. So this is basically what I'm asking, but I haven't had a chance to read this article yet. I think the gist of it was version them with files and push them to a registry or S3.
Well, I mean, I guess there are multiple ways to do it, but yeah, this sounds plausible.
Yeah.
So we do this.
Hopefully the whole Cruft approach helps us do this as well. So it would just be you update the upstream template and then all the versions downstream get updated. You see what I mean?
Oh, Cruft. But, well, I mean, Yeah, I don't see necessarily how Cruft helps, I guess, solve this. I guess it would help, yeah, it would help the downstream projects perhaps. But it, the repo itself, let's say we had a Terraform project with, you know, with 100 monorepo with 100 modules in there, and each one needs to be independently versioned.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Yeah. But yes, yeah, somebody mentioned Spacelift. I believe they use a monorepo strategy. Did I cut somebody else off there?
So I was just going to say, we do it a little bit with tooling. It's not a very sophisticated approach, but you know, Git stores the full version history, and then we push to a code artifact repository, the, you know, whether it's Docker or Python modules or what have you, push versions of the modules or Dockers or whatever to a repository.
Did you mention, I missed the first part of it. How are you managing the versions? Did you say you had a file or were you using something else?
Oh, no, so it's just, we're using Git, you know, you look in the Git commits for the versions. And so if you want to pull a particular version of the module, then you do that through the code artifact.
But they are, it's using tags in the end?
Yeah, essentially it's using tags or in, you know, the PyPy, you know, in the Python repository, you can pull specific versions.
Yeah.
So it's, as I say, it's not particularly sophisticated, but we, you know, the mono repo holds the all sorts of truth, not all that well organized, but then if you want to pull particular versions, you can pull those from code artifact.
All right. Thank you for sharing that.
I don't know if anyone else had another question, but I had another one if no one does it.
I think it's yours.
So basically, we have, I think, in the hundreds of these repos where each one of them has maybe $100,000 to $200,000 per month, I think, on. And you know, it adds up to a phenomenal amount of, you know, the AWS bill. And so it comes to the question of how do you manage all of that? So how much as a percentage, I don't know, if say it's 20% of that could be stuff which is not used at all, but it was still getting billed for. And it's actually quite difficult to determine what is in use if you're not the person who created it. Because if you actually look at a lot of the resources, they show is, you know, the last activity, say, could have been today, but it will just be AWS updating something automatically, so it looks like it's active, if you see what I mean. So
yeah,
you know, to leave the company and so on. So how much of the, what could be millions in AWS fees are we paying that are just, you know,
yeah,
stranded assets basically? And that, yeah, how do you detect that?
Anyone else want to take this first?
Sometimes in the past, not really regarding to this, but for specific features or some other things that we have announced for, hey, these are really end of life and people are not listening, some kind of brownout strategy also works. Basically, it's like the beep strategy. You turn it off for a small time and see if there's some push popping up. It's not the most sophisticated one, but it does work in various cases. And then also then you get hold of the people that are really using it. So that also helps.
So I think this is probably where commercial solutions will come in. Things like NOps, cloud, forget the other popular one. A lot of them, but like, if you want to build something yourself, since we're all engineers, right? That's the first inclination we have. But then they also goes to assume, like, are you guys using infrastructure as code consistently and other things? But I think using a some sort of a tagging strategy where the tag is always updated at the last time it was modified, then you can use stuff like Steampipe, which is open source, to index everything that you have from Kubernetes to AWS to ECS to registries or whatnot. You can literally then just query for it and select for everything that has not been updated for some amount of time. Then you can start doing the scream test. So you first need to identify the things that you might want to decommission, and then you do what Michael Percival said and pause it.
Yeah. If it is all infrastructure as code, you could at least start with the last time the repo was updated on, like, in there, yeah, and start, like, narrow down all the things that you need to look at. So while you might have, you know, several hundred, if they're all at least actively used and maintained, you probably cut that down to, you know, a much smaller list of repos to take a look at that haven't been updated in the last 3 months or 6 months or 9 months or 12 months or whatever, you know, figure out whatever makes sense and then start with those. And then maybe there's a way that you can start to narrow it down, like Eric said, by looking at resources under there. And there are probably other ways to do it. I mean, obviously, if there's any persistent storage in any of those things, in any of those resources, you could easily see, like, when's the last time table rows were written, or when's the last time something was written to this S3 bucket, or, you know, those things to determine, is this really being used, you know, right now at all? But there's no, I don't know of any real good, just higher level, you know, all use case, really easy to determine kind of way, other than doing a few steps to try to determine it.
But it's an interesting problem you bring up. And I think, if this was, you know, consistently a problem, how would you go about it? And maybe building in some kind of telemetry into all of your products, so they phone home some, you know, asynchronous requests, they just spin off. So you just know generally what's being utilized or what's not.
Yeah. Yeah, I think those are some really good ideas or places to start at the very least. I think some of the problems with that, though, is that a lot of it won't necessarily be, you know, some repo that's, you know, the resources still exist for. And so that's obviously, if it hasn't been updated in 2 years, it might not be even in use, yeah, and we can get rid of that. But the issue is when you have, especially if you have a big monorepos where there's, you know, thousands of resources, a lot of those resources within a very active monorepo could be, you know, not used essentially. So I think that's the part where it gets very tricky to try and disentangle things, because things which haven't been updated in a while might be core things that everything runs off of, is, you know, critical.
It could be
that. I wasn't suggesting automatically delete them. I would just say it'd give you a good list of what to look at. For sure. The other thing that I didn't mention is for servers or services that are running, like, HTTP workloads, as an example, CloudWatch is another good place to see, like, when's the last time you actually had, like, log activity for those services, assuming you're capturing them all, like, you know, all those things. But none of it's easy. I completely agree.
Yeah, multi-pronged approach, I think. Cool. Any other questions? We got a little bit more time.
I have less of a question, kind of just an open-ended observation. This week was my first time starting to use the storage optimized AWS EC2 instances that have the NVMe drives that are essentially attached to the instance. And in some cases they're, like, formatted and mounted and available. In other cases, they're not. And I've found when tying this into an EKS cluster, it surprisingly, there's not a great, or there's not a lot of support out there for like some type of way to, you know, like instantiate these devices and mount them and then make them available to the cluster. I found a few different ways to go about it. You know, there's like a SIG on the local static provisioner, but that still relies on the disk being available to the operating system. And so I was just surprised because it seems like EKS is a very mature product by this point and storage optimized instances have been around for a while. But I was just kind of surprised that there wasn't as much support around, you know, actually leveraging these storage optimized instances and using the NVMe drives kind of like out of the box.
Have you reached out to like your AWS rep to get connected with somebody on the product team for that? They sometimes have ideas.
It's not so much that I have like, you know, I'm working through it. I was just kind of making an observation that it seems like it something that more people would be doing and there would be a greater amount of support for. I was just curious if anybody else on the call is using those types of instances within Kubernetes.
We are, but we use, so we take a user data script that runs Ansible. We have a lot of stuff that we're doing that we're adding to that instance before it actually gets added to the cluster anyway, though. So it's kind of just part of that process for that as like a role that that sets up the NVMe drive. But it's probably overkill if you're not also adding other stuff to the instance.
Yeah, I was actually, that was exactly what I was going to suggest is that I can't say that I have that exact experience, but if there are things you need to do to prep the node to be able to be added to the cluster, like usually, you know, the init script, either cloud init or user init or whatever will be the best place to run something, you know, some set of commands to do that, check to see if the volume is mounted, if it's not mounted, you know, actually run the commands that you need to mount it. And then like that will start up on, you know, that all those things will run before it tries to actually join itself to the cluster.
Right. And so am I understanding correctly that there's like essentially the two phases, there's formatting and mounting the drive, and then there's using some type of provisioner to actually get it, you know, created as a persistent volume. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's my understanding. Okay. As well. Yes.
For the second phase, it seems like I've found like the EBS CSI driver. It says on their GitHub page that they support NVMe drives, but I haven't really found any. It's listed in their features, but I can't find anything within. I found one PR that kind of said they added support, but no documentation on how to use it. So that was one option. And then the other option I found was the local static provisioner. Are you guys using either one of those?
Yeah, that, I was saying, like, I don't actually have this specific use case of experience, but I was just giving you a more generalized like answer about how you might accomplish it. So I can't help you for the specific answer, but other than you can run a bunch of things before you join, you know, before you join the cluster, that was kind of what my TLDR answer was. Admittedly, might not be that helpful for your specific situation.
No. It's great to hear that somebody else has challenged.
I could be wrong, but I think we have a snapshot set up that we then use to create the NVMe drive. So it already has the partition. But again, I'm not 100% sure on, again, I haven't looked at it in a while. It's in our Ansible repo, but we do use NVMe drives and then set up those, mount it before it actually gets added to the cluster.
Okay. And then last thing on this, to actually take advantage of the storage optimized instances, is there a significant cost difference between using like an EBS volume that's attached to those instances versus using the NVMe drive? Like, is the NVMe drive why they're storage optimized and how you kind of take advantage of that technology. That may not be clear.
Well, you're not paying the network transfer for EBS that you would be, right, with a normal drive.
Got it.
But from a I'd have to look at the, I don't know, I'd have